Hello, Blogging Heads Nation. Welcome to the latest edition of Dresbert. I am Daniel Dresner. I'm a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy.
And I'm Heather Hurlburt, senior advisor at Human Rights First. And today, if I look a little strained, it's because there's a short in my earphones and I'm clutching them with two fingers to make them work.
Oh, dear. Sorry about that. Yes, we're in unusual places. I'm in my office as opposed to home, which is normally where I record this. So you have to see the scribblings that my child drew behind me, which really makes for a fetching visual. Yes. Well, they're on a whiteboard, so it's not quite as adorable as you might think, but still pretty adorable. So we're going to, start off this discussion of world politics where it seems like you always start off with discussions of world politics, which is George Kennan, which is to say that George Kennan is like the Tupac of international relations scholarship. In that even though Kennan has died a couple of years ago, there continue to be releases and re-releases of new Kennan material, whether it be John Lewis Gaddis's sort of authoritative biography, or in this case now the publication of some more of his memoirs. And the memoirs have some pretty shocking stuff in it.
So Kennan was a prolific, not to say compulsive, diarist, and what's released is a selection, a 700-page selection, I might add, beginning when he was 11 and really ending at or shortly before his death. And so that's 80, I should be able to add better than this, 89 years, 88 years. I think the other thing that's worth pointing out about Kennan that I find fascinating, and that I actually think it would be wrong to reduce him to sort of, oh, Kennan, he was a bigoted white guy, is that the thing that rings quite profoundly in the X article, all these years later, is, he says, the most important thing we have to do is give the world a clear vision of ourselves as a country that knows where it's going and is solving its problems. And of course, the way that the U.S. did that so successfully was around all the things that, that Kennan really didn't like. It was, letting women like me and Jews like you have an equal say, and, not to mention Blacks, Hispanics, gays, and all the rest of us, letting us have access to the vote, to the levers of power, to equality in the workplace. And, it's those struggles and the success of those struggles without turning over our society that are so inspiring. And, by the way, that also inspire the people in communist countries that ultimately, overturn their governments. And so the part that Kennan was right about is the part that's least Kennan-esque, if you will.
Although you could argue, I think that reads Kennan. I think you're partially right. I'm not entirely sure I agree with you because in no small part because I think in some ways the sort of best aspects of the X article is not so much the prescription for what the United States should do, but rather the explanation for why the Soviets are acting the way they do.
Yes. And in that sense, by the way, we get it wrong when we talk about Kennan as a policymaker because he just wasn't very good as a policymaker for a number of reasons, one of which was he just didn't deal very well with other people.
Yes.
But as an analyst, and again, it helps to have, it does turn out that to be an analyst, it helps to have a bit of a jaundiced view of things.
Yes, that I'm certainly not going to deny that. Let me step back one second and ask you a somewhat deeper question, though, which is, God knows, someone who studies international relations, the sort of bigotry on display in Kennan's diaries. And to be fair, again, there's a distinction. You do want to at least draw something of a distinction between what he says in private versus what he says, in a foreign affairs article, which is at least his recognition that maybe his views are, that he's holding privately are probably not something that should be broadcast. Although I think the most disturbing thing about the Greenberg review in the New Republic was the fact that apparently he did want to publish parts of these diaries while he was alive. And Wallace Shawn basically explained to his agent, there's a bit of a problem with this. And Kennan wrote in his diary, I think, something to the effect of, well, I don't understand why he thinks there are anti-Semitic views in this diary, although after hearing this news, now I'm really feeling pretty anti-Semitic. That was that was a little bit disconcerting. But just to step back for a second, at what point, you know, I agree with you that you don't want to tar and feather Kennan just because of his racist views. But, you know, you have to be fair-minded in terms of applying that brush. And God knows how many other historical figures, you know, from the 20th century you managed to paint with that sort of, you know, charge of what they believed, even if it doesn't necessarily correspond with what they actually did. I mean, is there a proper way in which you can factor that into your assessment historically of the way people matter?
Well, I mean, just first I want to say that Kennan, before World War II, was advocating taking the vote away from women and immigrants. In public, he was advocating this, which was extreme even in that day.
Yeah.
So just, you know, just to stress that this isn't a guy who just sort of hid his views at home. But I think the sort of the consistent way of approaching it, or how I try to be consistent, is when you find something out about people, does that make what they did more impressive or less impressive? So, you know, the great number of people, starting with both Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, who, you know, were not above a certain level of anti-Semitism, for example. And yet both of them, you know, had both some really dramatic failings as far as what they didn't do around the Holocaust, and some really important things that they did do, and some things that Eleanor in particular recognized afterward that she had been wrong about. And so there, I don't feel inclined to let it lower my judgments. Say people who crusaded very hard for racial equality, but, you know, didn't feel the same way about women. You know, it doesn't lessen what they did. I think the last thing, you know, is that it's one should, I think anyway, I know this is not a universal view, judge people's actions based on their actions and look at what we subsequently find out about their views as having important explanatory or historical power. If that makes sense. But, you know, I mean, it was like, it's like Wagner, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is not really different from, do you listen to Wagner's music or do you not?
Yeah, no. Let me put it this way. It's an unfair question because I don't necessarily have a great answer for it myself. But there are times where, you know, it's the way in which, you know, historical reputations rise and fall, you know, over time. Think about Woodrow Wilson, for example, where, you know, Wilson, you know, at various times has been seen as a great American statesman, you know, really the sort of person to you know, try to at least evince something of the form of a humane global order. And yet, on the other hand, was truly a world-class racist. I mean, you know, just as that becomes clear. And the question is, how do you reconcile these things or you know, potentially historically? But I don't think they're necessarily going to have a way to answer it today. But there is something I wanted to ask you, because there was something you wrote, you quoted it here, but in your World Politics for USA, which I liked, there's something you quote from Kennan. I want to put a question to you where you say, you know, the point that Kennan made was to create among the peoples of the world generally the impression of a country which knows what it wants, which is coping successfully with the problem of its internal life and with the responsibilities of world power, and which has a spiritual vitality capable of holding its own among the major ideological currents of the time. You know, in some ways, it's almost the notion of the projection of both an idea that a country wants to promote and also the competency with which it promotes that idea. How would you grade the Obama administration on that criteria right now?
Oh, well, two things before we get to the grade. One being that it was a hell of a lot easier to project those things back when governments had much more monopoly power over information than they do now.
Mm-hmm.
So an American president, an American Secretary of State could project a view of America that there weren't, you know, there wasn't satellite TV to countermand. So that would be my first point. And my second point is in some ways what Kennan is describing there is soft power or smart power.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, it's a very unrealist attitude that he's taking. And so I just, both of those are worthy of note.
Hold on. I want to push back on you a little bit on that. You're right that on the one hand, he's talking about soft power, but I think he's talking about something else, which is prestige, which is the notion that it's not just a question of the values that are being promoted. It's also the competency with which they're being promoted. And I think that was something.
But isn't that also just a form of soft power? I mean, how is that not soft power?
Well, it's one thing to evince a set of values. It's another thing to be seen as doing it well. In other words, it's the competency issue that I think is also partly going on here. One can presumably competently promote. Think about the way in which some people are perceiving Vladimir Putin right now in Ukraine. Even though there might be people who are diametrically opposed to what Putin is doing, there is nonetheless, clearly in some quarters, a sneaky admiration for the fact that Putin has essentially bloodlessly annexed the Crimea. Now, one could argue in a variety of ways that this actually might be a long-term problem for him. In fact, even there was a great New York Times story earlier this week about how it was a short-term problem for him. But nonetheless, the perception of that is, wow, look at what he managed to do. That's the thing I'm talking about.
Yeah, I don't actually think that's what Kenan is talking about, but I see what you mean. One thing I would say is that America as a society, I would give a pretty bad grade, in that we, not so much by any conscious choice, but not choosing is also a choice. What we now send overseas is a lot of movies, a lot of consumerism, a lot of anger. In the form of how our political rhetoric gets exported. So if you're consuming the public discourse that America produces, the sense that you get of us is not a very
stable,
positive state. Well, stable, positive, interested in larger things than ourselves. I mean, it's a pretty self-interested and not very competent, to return to your point, vision of ourselves that we put forward with a lot of really cool gizmos, and a nice standard of living. So, in that sense, we still do great. As far as what this particular administration does, what I think it does well is to convey, that what we're not about is military solutions in other people's countries. And that what we're not about sort of the stereotype of U.S. quote imperialism unquote. And what it maybe has not done as well as it might have is to convey how the other pieces of what it's for add up to a vision that's helpful to everybody. That it's they work pretty hard to say, we don't want to invade your country. We don't want to tell you what to do. We don't want to change your government by force. But what is it that we do want? What is it that we do want to do with you? And I think, it's not that smart people in the White House don't have ideas about these things, but both because, there's a lot of other stuff going on, and because I think, frankly, there's a certain disdain for this kind of repeated handholding and messaging. The message doesn't get through.
I'd say that's actually really disturbing to hear that there is a disdain for that kind of handholding, because that's essentially what diplomacy is, right? This is what George Shultz referred to as gardening. This is, in some ways, the whole point, reassurance is not a minor part of diplomacy. And if the White House disdains it, this actually explains a fair amount about, let's say, the last couple of years of U.S. foreign policy.
Well, I think this is the moment to say something nice about both Hillary Clinton and John Kerry, and then maybe that gets us into some of the other things that John Kerry has said recently. But I must say, both Clinton and Kerry, in different ways, were very, very focused on being gardeners. And Clinton, I think, and this is a reason, it's just ridiculous. You have a front page story in the New York Times saying, oh, Hillary Clinton doesn't know whether she has a legacy at state or not. Well, of course she does. Her legacy at state is that John Kerry has something to do in the second term. She retilled the garden. That's actually a great metaphor. And Kerry has picked out several particular things that he's, cultivating very avidly, dumping a lot of fertilizer on. I couldn't resist that. You set that up nicely for me.
Sorry. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead. I agree with you totally on the fertilizer thing.
Yeah. But, so both of them, enormously to their credit, I think completely understand this point. Now, are there other people in the administration, and particularly on the political side of things, who don't have a lot of patience for that? Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I might accept that. I'm a little more down on Kerry in particular, I think, than you are, for a couple of reasons. The first is, you could argue that, again, and this is correct me if I'm wrong, because you're closer to Washington than I am, but the impression I get is that he really did devote a tremendous amount of time to trying to revitalize the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. And in an abstract sense, I can on the one hand admire the fact that he wanted to do that. And in some ways, the White House was perfectly willing to let him try to do that. You know, that's the sort of legacy building thing that secretaries of state try to do. And God knows if he had actually achieved it, it's a big thing. But again, the most scarce resource for a policy principle is time. And the amount of time Kerry devoted to this, and by doing so missed or has, you know, neglected other aspects of his job, I actually am increasingly appalled by. You know, to the point where I really do think, you know, the U.S. was caught flat-footed on Ukraine. To some extent, the sort of diplomatic side of the rebalancing to Asia, I think, has suffered. And that I'm not going to forgive him for, because I really do think that that's the part where he could have potentially done more, and I think he actually did not. I'll let you respond to that before I talk about something that he just said.
Yeah, I would add just one thing to complexify what you've just said, which is it's not the case that Kerry walked into a tabula rasa and was told, you know, you can pick any area of the world and play and you know, make that your priority, that there were big swaths of the world that either the White House had staked out that you know, for example, Russia is Joe Biden's.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's, you know, I don't know that Kerry actually could have. I mean, not that anybody, I mean, everybody, frankly, was caught flat-footed by what happened in Ukraine. But even if Kerry somehow hadn't been, I'm not sure domestic politics within the administration, he'd have been able to sort of say, I'm going to ditch Middle East peace and focus on this. So to some extent, I do think Kerry was making strategic choices based on the hand he was dealt internally.
Okay. The other thing is that, you know, he said something yesterday, which this also drives me nuts about Kerry, which is, you know, he has the tendency to just sort of speak off the cuff. You know, last week he talked about how it was awful that there were these anti-Semitic flyers being, you know, passed around in Donetsk. It turned out that it's not likely that those anti-Semitic flyers came from the sort of Russian separatists, which is not to endorse the Russian separatists, but it's to basically say John Kerry shouldn't have said anything about that. But more importantly, he apparently said yesterday in a speech where he was asked about, you know, changing global power dynamics. He said, during the Cold War, it was easier than it is today. Simpler is maybe a way to put it. The choices were less varied, less complicated, more stark, more clear. Communism, democracy, West, East, Iron Curtain. And then he said multiple emerging powers unleashed forces like radical Islam and too many failed states and so on and so forth. And then in the post-war 1950s and 60s, Kerry said we could make really bad decisions and still win because we were pretty much the sole dominant economic and military power around. It's not true anymore. Now, there are parts of those statements that I agree with, but the larger notion that this was somehow easier or simpler during the Cold War, I find really problematic in the sense of this leads to this sort of, you know, nostalgia about, why can't we, you know, do things the same way we did during the Cold War, missing the fact that actually in the Cold War, the Soviet Union actually acted as a far more formidable veto player on a whole bunch of things than Russia does now. And in some ways, it leads to this myth that somehow the United States is less powerful now than we were during the Cold War, when in fact, I think that's an absurd comparison.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think it's, as you say, it's maybe a little regrettably off the cuff that Kerry said that. And I also agree with you that, you know, Cold War nostalgia is of absolutely no use to anyone. I also think that it's kind of, especially for people who, you know, you and I were mere children when the Cold War ended. We were admittedly children with college degrees, and but you know, for somebody whose whole worldview was shaped by the Cold, I mean, I'm sure he genuinely feels that it was simpler.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, my problem with the statement is actually, yes, it was simpler and that wasn't a good thing. And the times it was simpler were the times we got things most drastically wrong. Mm-hmm. So that statement is both true and it should spark sort of serious reexamination. But, you know, for many people, it was simpler.
Right. I guess, you know what, it's the distinction between simpler versus easier. I think in some ways, yes, yeah. I do agree. Yeah. It was somewhat simpler. But the notion that it was somehow easier or safer, I find not just absurd, but I actually find really, really dangerous. Because again, it leads to this sort of nostalgia view and a misplaced perception of why things were done during the Cold War versus why those same things should not necessarily be done now. And it goes to this point that I think Jacob Heilbronn brought up in an essay in the National Interest on the sort of misuses of historical analogies. And the notion that the favorite U.S. analogy to use is either, 1938 Munich or the Cold War. And while I'm not necessarily opposed to the idea of rethinking the general strategy about Russia in response to what they've done in Ukraine, I really do. In some ways, the most disturbing and frustrating thing for me from the Obama administration in the second term has been the ways in which the White House in particular has tried to play down what's happened and at the same time has occasionally made these sort of random statements saying this shall not stand. It vexes me to no end. But at the same time, I'm not necessarily sure you want to see, the notion that you want to revive and, or create a new Cold War. I'm not sure is practical or necessarily in U.S. interest in the long term.
Well, I mean, so to just sort of go through a couple of things in turn there. I think the last thing I want to say that a reason I find easier to be really problematic is during the Cold War, it wasn't a fear, it wasn't hype, it was a certainty that there were weapons pointed at us on trigger, and if you were a policymaker at a senior level during those years and you didn't think about that just about every day of your life, then frankly, you weren't doing your job. And so that's actually the place that I would really quarrel with Kerry and say, you think that was easy? The fact that nothing is going to happen today that is going to wipe out the United States as we know it. I feel quite confident saying that.
As the author of a book about zombies, I can't quite be as certain, but I generally share your assessment.
I was going to say, it would be so awesome if a zombie popped up in the window that you can see in the background just about at this point. I wonder if the Blogging Heads guys can Photoshop that in, because it would be really funny if something like Bloodstained sort of put one creepy hand up. But that's the thing about – that's the obscenity. And by the way, also we had those weapons poised to do that to the Russians. And that's the obscenity about, the Cold War was easy.
And not to mention, let me add – I would add here, the ways in which we almost came close to doing that accidentally – which, Scott Sagan 20 years ago and Eric Schlosser most recently have written about in terms of sort of nuclear accidents, is utterly terrifying. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. No, and there was something else I wanted to say to your contemporary point about this administration, and I have now forgotten what it was. So I'll hand the mic back to you.
Aha! It was a brilliant strategy by me to make sure my point goes uncontested.
Pretty much, yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I will – So, I'll give you one more opportunity to answer, which is, I think what I said was that what annoys me about the White House's response to the Russian, both annexation of the Crimea and what they're doing in eastern Ukraine is that they kind of blow hot and cold on it. There's this sort of blasé attitude about, we don't want to play, make too big of a deal of this because we think Russia is a declining power. And yet at the same time, they start saying, making sort of empty rhetorical statements like, this will not stand, we will not recognize this, this will be reversed, when it's not obvious to me at all how this will be reversed.
Right. Thanks. So, thank you, because now I remember what I wanted to say back. And I want to preface it with, this is a very funny point in the life of an administration. And I have to say, I sort of sit here thinking, I'm not interested in piling on them. I'm interested in criticizing if I think I have something constructive to say. But just in general, it's awfully easy to sit here and snipe. And so in general, I know, that the sort of the viewership is like, she's a horrible apologist, whatever. And you know what? I am. I confess I'm an apologist because it's freaking hard. So having said that, I think they don't intend to blow hot and cold. They intend not to provoke a Cold War mindset in the U.S. while trying to figure out how to deal with the problem seriously. And this, it actually goes back to your question about how I would grade this administration, because I think, they haven't cracked the code, but frankly, I haven't cracked the code. I don't think Hillary Clinton has cracked the code. I don't think any Republican contenders have cracked the code of how to talk to Americans about this stuff, how to get enough attention in the middle of the sort of crazy that is our media marketplace and the even crazier that is our politics to have a serious national discussion of any of this stuff. So, like, you know, if I wanted to have a serious national debate on, you know, what is the right policy to have toward Russia now? How do we think about it? How do we think about the next 5 years? You know, I don't know that I could, in good faith, say to the White House, "Hey, you guys should spend a lot of time working on that," because that's just nuts out here in the maelstrom. So, you know, I have a lot of empathy for what I think they're doing, which is not as disjointed as what you described. Although I recognize what you're portraying as, you know, what you see when you're just sitting out here.
Yeah, no, and you know, I grant you that, but we, you know, I've always been sitting out here, so, you know, I'm an equal opportunity, criticizer on this. I guess the one thing I would push back on is the notion that I don't think the White House, I don't think the administration wants to even have the public conversation you're talking about. You're right that doing that would be incredibly difficult, but I'm not sure they even want to do it. To the extent of this is not something they like talking about publicly. And this is where I would like to see, you know, in some ways, this is where I, as sick as I am occasionally of the, you know, the sort of question about why Obama doesn't show leadership, yada, yada, yada. Leadership in this case would actually be willing to talk about this sort of stuff, because you're right. He's still, you know, it won't necessarily make much difference in, you know, maybe maybe there's limits to what that kind of debate would actually have. But you know what? You're the president, and this is one of the few things you can do, which is you can actually try to say you want to have a conversation about this. And he hasn't done that.
Well, I'm now going to be equal opportunity nice about the Republicans for a change. And I'm going to predict that the most interesting conversation about where the U.S.-Russia relationship goes and how that fits into world affairs is going to be held between John McCain on the one hand and Rand Paul on the other. Yeah. And that is going to be a fascinating conversation. And it's going to have, you know, frankly, some elements that are political and silly and abhorrent to me, but it's going to have some that are really interesting and provocative and important. And, you know, I don't think that's going to happen publicly in my party's establishment right now, but I do think it's going to happen among Republicans. And it's going to be, I mean, not to sort of say, not to take away from the size of what's happening in the region, but the politics of it in the U.S. are going to be very interesting.
No, I agree with you. That's an excellent point, which is to say there is genuinely going to be a foreign policy debate in the GOP side for 2016. Whereas, I mean, unless the contours of the race dramatically change on the Democratic side, that's not going to happen. We should probably close out with, you know, speaking of the Obama administration and foreign policy, they are president is now, I believe, in Japan. Am I correct on that?
I think that's right.
Yeah. You know, starting his Pacific Rim goodwill / reassurance / yes, we're aware about rebalancing his tour. Any thoughts, Heather?
Well, you know, I got asked on TV last night for what I thought this administration's achievements were. And, you know, what I said was that one of the things that I think we will have a hard time judging in the near term, but that's going to prove very successful in the long term, is having reset a foundation. And the rebalance for all of the sort of back and forth and fussing about it, you know, the relations with Japan, the relations with South Korea, the relations with the Philippines, the relationship with Australia are all as strong as they've been or stronger in, you know, years, if not decades. And this trip is not going to be the sort of victory lap that might have been hoped, because you have so much anger and angst about domestic issues in a number of these countries. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that that we're in very strong shape there. And so that is, you know, in a way, the fact that those visits are going to go off pretty easily is a major achievement, and it's a major achievement of the rebalance. Now, will that satisfy the people who say, no, we need more attention, more focus? No, it probably won't. You know, the other part of rebalance that's hard is if it bleeds, it leads. And, you know, your biggest success in Asia is keeping more things from bleeding.
Yeah. No, and you can argue in some ways it's both the nicest thing to say about the administration. It's also the most frustrating thing to say. That you can argue that the Obama administration's greatest foreign policy triumph is that it has avoided major disasters. And by disasters, I mean it hasn't committed a policy, you know, or staked itself out on a policy that led to massive costs in the form of blood and treasure. Which on the one hand, you might say is a low bar, but on the other hand, if you take a look at the history of post-1945 U.S. foreign policy, it's still actually a pretty significant achievement. The problem is that it's a negative achievement, in to say that they haven't done, you know, something. It's harder to point to positive accomplishments. I mean, I'm with you in the sense of, I like the rebalancing strategy from the beginning. I thought it was the right thing to do. I think in some ways the task for Obama on this trip should in fact be to highlight the point of just because if it bleeds, it leads doesn't mean this still isn't the most important part of the globe. The problem is you're right. The natural tension is to pay have attention focused on areas where things are going to crap, either, you know, Ukraine or Syria or what have you, you know, unless of course a plane goes down, in which case all bets are off. But maybe that's what the Obama administration needs to do. Have a few more planes go missing in the Pacific Rim to sort of refocus attention back on that region. And that way point out the virtues of the pivot. I'm 99% joking on this.
The one point I would make from the sort of, this is the way that I'm a realist in that I'm a realist about how people respond to things, but you can't actually right now is maybe the worst time in the last 4 or 5 years to say Asia is the most important part of the world, because if you say that, you're giving Russia a free pass in Eastern Europe. So you actually, however much other times you might have thought that was a good thing to say, you can't say it right now. It's really diplomatic malpractice to say it right now.
No, that's right. Which again shows the extent to which, I mean, they're boxed in, because I think it's one of these things where you or I could say this, because I think, you know, we would agree, and because we don't have a public voice, and because that's actually accurate. But you're right, they can't. Which perhaps again, you know, summarizes the theme for this entire blogging head session, which is this shit is hard.
So I actually will provide a little teaser for next time, which is to say that I actually don't think it's ever a good idea to say Asia is the most important region of the world. And I'm by the next time we tape, I will be ready to have a debate with you about it.
I look forward to that. The other thing we might be looking forward to talking to next week or next time is I'm holding up my advanced copy of my book that's coming out in 6 weeks called The System Worked. So hopefully we will talk about that as well, about what happened after 2008.
Very good. Thanks, and good talking to you.
Good talking to you. Take care.